the fundamental reason for building the nuclear power plants for peacetime use was to actually breed plutonium that can then be used for missiles. And this was the main purpose. And that all of the talk about low-cost electrical usage was a farce. I mean, everything in our life is totally artificial. And the urban industrial era has only been with us for, what, several hundred years. If you were to take a look at the tendency of human beings on the planet, how long we've been here, and that was an hour on a clock, this urban industrial culture is just a tiny, tiny fraction of a second before midnight. And we're using this, we assume that this is the standard. As if, you know, this is the way it always was, and this is the way it always will be. That's a vast illusion.
Everyone living in this country has issues directly affecting them in their lives today. And I'm a strong advocate of taking direct action to make the changes. If government is resistant to the kinds of changes that need to be made, get together with your friends and take a direct action. Go ahead and chain yourself to a bulldozer if necessary.
We continue our discussion with John Milton, one of the world's most outstanding ecologists, right now on Alternative Views. John Milton is a co-founder of Friends of the Earth and has also written several books on the environment. This is the second in our two-part series with John, in which we're discussing the ecological problems of the world.
What is it particularly that's polluting the air? What's causing ozone pollution and smog and air pollution and global warming trends? Obviously, the air is part of this ecosystem that's under assault, just like the soil and the water.
Gosh, everything.
Everything.
if you think about it, we live in such a highly technological and industrial system that we're becoming increasingly dependent upon our, you know, synthetic chairs. I mean, just look what we're wearing. I try to wear natural cottons as much as possible, and I'm wearing shoes made of cork, but I still have a little rubber that's partly synthetic, cotton socks. If we just analyze ourselves and start looking at what we're using and what we walk around with, this is organic in a sense. This is natural, Bisbee turquoise. It's quite astounding. I mean, right from our clothing right on out into our environment, we're increasingly living within a cultural ecosystem that sucks resources out of the natural ecosystem, calls it natural resources, converts it into stuff that we place value upon. And in the process of all the transformations that occur, particularly when we shift into things like synthetic plastics and many of all the different artificial kinds of chemicals that we've created, it's astounding. There's so many pollutants in the atmosphere at this point that I don't think we even have the tiniest clue of what each one of those chemicals is doing. When you take a look at the windblown fertilizers, the pesticides, all the trace poisons in the atmosphere from all the different kinds of chemical plants and different kinds of processing plants, and you take a look at the gross ozone release from the automobiles and the nitrogen and sulfuric acid releases. I lived in an area in southern Arizona that was being impacted with some of the heaviest SO2 pollution in the world from the copper smelters built by Phelps Dodge down there.
SO2 being?
It's the sulfuric acid base. And for about 7 years, my friends who were asthmatics, and there were several of them died. Babies were being born with in horrible condition, and people were walking around coughing, wheezing, phlegm coming out of their lungs every day of their life. It took myself and two others decided enough. And we had a series of strategy sessions in the early 80s, and we constructed a campaign to basically turn this around, close that smelter down, or the three smelters involved. And we then kicked off a campaign that drew tremendous local support groups. We had a group called GASP, and then it caught on a little more, got more attention from a few national organizations that joined in and helped. And eventually we actually closed the smelter. I think it was 2 years ago we closed the smelter down, but we had to have many very direct actions in front of that smelter, which is right on the Mexican border. Route 666 dead ends in that smelter, which the Christians will appreciate that. And we basically had a series of what we call die-ins, because at that time the EPA, said it was acceptable to have
acceptable risk
to have 128 or 129 deaths in the immediate area that year. To it was okay from the smelter. We shouldn't really put too much pressure on Phelps Dodge. We had a die-in where we went down and we had 128 people die in front of the smelter, and just to publicize that attitude and that value. Not to mention the fact that that smelter was the source of virtually all of the major source of acid rain for the entire Rocky Mountain region. That meant that the Rocky Mountain region only had a few years to go before the lakes and the forests began to die in the same way that the forests and the lakes of the Appalachians have already died. So that was a unique opportunity for us to actually go in, take an action, and to do to take an action in a peaceful way, but basically a direct action which would hopefully get some results. It actually did manage to turn things around. There's a lot that people can do if they're willing to be good ecological warriors with a compassionate hearts.
They're finding the same thing now with nuclear plants, not even to mention the nuclear weapons that have been set off, the nuclear bomb testing that has occurred in the air in the past and the ground still. But now they're finding that the death rates and other health problems have skyrocketed in just within the areas of nuclear plants. Similar to what you're talking about, but you can't see it, and it's difficult to measure, so they don't do anything about that.
Well, the nuclear level is that represents such a level of insanity, I find it almost impossible to conceive of that level of demonic force being consciously brought into the planet.
And that means nuclear energy as well as nuclear weapons.
Yes.
I mean, both of them have the same
peaceful
destructive
use of
effect.
Nuclear energy is a total...
It's a fraud.
Fraud.
Right.
Because, basically, Emery Levins, an old friend of mine, did one of the best analyses of this process of anybody that I know. He runs an institute in the Rocky Mountains now for resource analysis, an excellent group. But in any case, Amory pointed out a number of years ago, after doing some very careful research, that the fundamental reason for building the nuclear power plants for peacetime use was to actually breed plutonium that could then be used for missiles. And this was the main purpose. And that all of the talk about low-cost electrical usage was a farce. Now, the other thing that nobody has taken into account with these nuclear plants, I mean, they don't work. They work for a few years, and then something generally will go wrong and closes them down. They're very inefficient. They're costly to build, and they're very inefficient. The cost of decommissioning a nuclear power plant has rarely been taken into account. And decommissioning costs, we now estimate, on the average, will run at least 2 to 3 times more than the cost of building the plant.
Gosh. Insane.
Nobody has thought about those costs in terms of what we're handing on to our future generations. You know, what they will have to pay.
It's making profit today and then leaving the consequences for tomorrow.
The
federal deficit's another example of this mentality.
Yes. And if this is the case, I mean, Well, it's awesome because we're talking about handing on a cost here that is going to be incredibly massive for the future, on top of all of the other burdens that we're passing along. And then we have on top of that things like Chernobyl, which happened, and those kinds of things are going to happen increasingly if we shift towards nuclear. I read recently that the cost of cleaning up Chernobyl will be in excess of $300 billion. That is, the, as I recall, about the size of our entire military budget in this country. That's just to clean up one nuclear power plant catastrophe. $300 billion. And people talk about peaceful use of nuclear energy as a wonderful alternative to fossil fuels and various other things. The thing is that when Reagan came into power, there was a man named Dennis Hayes, a close friend of mine, who was working for Solar Energy Research Institute in Colorado. He was building, he's the chairperson for Earth Day, interestingly enough. Dennis came out to visit and give a talk in Illinois just after the Reagan administration came in. And Dennis, when I saw Dennis at the airport, he looked kind of pale. I figured he had a hard time. Asked him what was wrong, and he said, "Well, I've been fired." And I said, "Well, what's going on?" And he said, "Well, the Reagan administration is going to dismantle and basically put out of business, except for a little bit of research, all solar energy initiatives in this country. And he's going to put in place atomic and nuclear energy initiatives." That man, Ronald Reagan, our great president, put us behind on environmental initiatives that could have really put us ahead. We could have gone ahead and prepared ourselves for an entry into the only kind of energy system that makes sense, which is renewable energy source. I mean, all the plants do it. They depend on the sun. We depend on it in almost every way if we think about it a little bit. Reagan put us behind it at least a decade during a period when all the crisis curves were going up at that rate. And I'm not sure we'll ever get past that period that he put us behind. The ignorance, the vast ignorance of that period, people do not realize. But it will come home to roost, and unfortunately, in the near future. The only way to go is a good, strong renewable energy resource program, which depends on things like solar, wind, small mini hydro plants, and a variety of other sources that basically work with the energy of the earth and the energy of the sun.
And can that generate enough to keep up a sustainable standard of living?
Sure, easily.
John, we've talked about these various separate different things that are ecological disasters and big problems. We didn't even mention things like TV monitors and video display terminals, which they start kids in kindergarten and first grade. They radiate and can hurt people. I mean, they're kind of like mini nuclear plants in that sense. The first question is, what can you tell us about that? And the second question is, of all these things we've talked about, they certainly must have some type of interactive, synergistic relationship which can make all these worse.
Right. Well, the electromagnetic pollution is a subject that interests me very much because it has been relatively ignored. I think we began to become aware of it when there was a lot of the use of it as a military weapon. I guess when the Russians were zapping the American embassy in Moscow. But in point of fact, electromagnetic pollution has become a major source of imbalance of the human body and the mind and the emotions in almost every American city. It's interesting that direct current tends to be a much smoother kind of electrical current than alternating current. Alternating current literally introduces a jerky vibration into the human body. It lives near those fields, and they're constantly going like this. And pretty soon you start literally kind of, at a very subtle level, doing that too. Now, if you live near high-tension power lines, high-tension is probably a good word for them. And you add on to that all of the different kinds of radio and television and all the different kinds of waves which are constantly bombarding us. My feeling is that we are it's having a major effect on the health of the energy body. We're just beginning to realize from studies in Chinese medicine, which again the American medical community would like to ignore, but unfortunately acupuncture is so well proven by now that they had to acknowledge that in fact there are energy flows. I'm having a treatment right now with an acupuncture, a couple of acupuncture points for a bad tooth. When they began to see that pain control was so effective with acupuncture, and they began to see that certain kinds of Qigong and Tai Chi movement exercises were so beneficial in the hospitals in China, they began to say, okay, there is something here, and maybe there is something to this theory of energy flow through the meridians of the body. The basic thing about electromagnetic pollution is that it completely imbalances the natural energy flow through those meridians of the body. And I'm convinced it's one of the sources of disease. I mean, disease is basically dis-ease, lack of full bodily and mental and emotional ease. And it seems like we've done everything possible to move out of that state. And maybe not intentionally, but if you think about it, the human organism evolved over millions of years in nature, surrounded by natural organic materials, eating fairly natural food like nuts and seeds and tubers and leafy shoots and things of that kind, probably some things from the edge of the sea. And we were living with relatively organic materials on our bodies, with clean air and environments which were very close to nature. And that was the way it was for millions of years. We lived in relatively small extended family environments and tribal environments, and we had people occasionally going out for periods of solo time to reconnect deeply with nature, and then would come back into the family. We're so far from that now. I mean, everything in our life is totally artificial. And the urban industrial era has only been with us for, what, several hundred years. If you were to take a look at the tendency of human beings on the planet, how long we've been here, and that was an hour on a clock, this urban industrial culture is just a tiny, tiny fraction of a second before midnight. And we're using this. We assume that this is the standard. As if, you know, this is the way it always was, and this is the way it always will be. That's a vast illusion. And this culture is not sustainable. It will not last. It is on the way out. The question is, what will replace it? What will replace it depends entirely on the actions that we take now and in the future. And it's one of the reasons that the ecological awakening is so important. But the main point I wanted to make is that our whole being, our emotions, our body, our mind, evolved or co-evolved with the organic system and fabric of life of the planet over millions of years. In a few hundred years, we replaced that with a totally synthetic and artificial existence. How can we possibly expect to be healthy, emotionally, mentally, or physically? It is no accident we're having diseases that are breakdowns of the immune system, breakdowns of the basic cellular system, like cancer. Cancer is behaving like we are. It is simply
growth out of control.
It's the reflection in our bodies of what we've become in relation to the planet. So if you think about it, cancer is a cell that it does not regulate itself. Mm-hmm. It grows without any control. The cancer spreads, it kills you, it kills the body. In a similar way, it has greed, it only wants to consume the resources of the rest of the organs of the body, the organ systems of the body. It doesn't care. It just wants to grow without limit. The human being, and it kills us. The human being is growing on the planet with no regard for all the organ systems of the planet, for Mother Gaia. It grows without any limit. It will grow until the planet is dead. That is how we are actually behaving. So, of course, our bodies are now reflecting cancer, which is simply the natural microcosmic reflection of our behavior, the behavior that we're inflicting upon Mother Earth herself. So, to talk about synergy, which was your other question, synergy, by the way, means synergy is where you look at the total net of the interrelated effects of all
the different actions and reactions of something. And you may have, let's say, a cumulative effect of, we have in our environment, stresses coming in from driving to work for 2 hours a day and beating on the steering wheel. I was talking to somebody about, who was a mechanic recently, working with air conditioning units, and I saw him down in Baja driving a Toyota, and he said, I said, what were you doing up there in California? He said, well, I used to repair air conditioning units in San Diego, and I liked it. I said, well, why'd you leave? And he said, well, too many years of driving on those freeways that got bigger and bigger and more stressed out. I began to see people literally going crazy on the road. They're pounding. You hear about the, you know, the shootings.
The shooting,
but
right.
What you don't hear about is the thousands, if not millions of people who, screaming, pounding on the steering wheel or trying to bottle it all up inside.
Right.
You don't hear so much about that. But that's what's going on. And you take that kind of stress, you add it to chemical pollutants, you add it to pesticides, you add it to poor nutrition, and so on. And the cumulative impact of all that taken together is synergistic. That means that when you add one kind of toxin to another toxin, you get something usually that's far more toxic than just the one thing alone. Most of our tests of the effect of environmental pollutants or poisons of one kind or another, be it a physiological stress or a literal toxin, chemical toxin, is single factor analysis. It means that we don't look at the total system and the total range of impacts that are working on that system simultaneously, as they actually do in nature, in the actual world. And through this single factor analysis, the EPA and the various standards of government set their standards for what's allowable in terms of a pollutant, for example. There's no interest in finding out what the sum total of all that is. If you took each one of those impacts and took a look at the impact of that on a human being or an animal, another kind of animal, I should say, there's no question that the cumulative impact would be far greater than the single factor alone. Far, far greater. A quantum shift greater. Mm. And we are not measuring for that. Nowhere in government. Nowhere in science. And yet that's what's actually going on. It's amazing.
And now we want to talk about what we can do, what we must do in order to prevent all these catastrophes, or less, maybe, heck, maybe Homo sapien isn't worth it. Maybe we should just, you know, shuffle off and give things back to the good animals of the world. But anyway, if we're going to do something, I guess we have to look at Earth in a different way than we have in the past. And you have, and some other people are doing this, aren't you?
Yeah, I think some really hopeful signs. One of the things that has particularly interested me is the growth, on the one hand, of a different philosophical view of what the human being is and what the Earth is, and the relationship of the human being to the Earth, and also to the matter, you know, the mother, mater, the Earth that we live with right here in our bodies. And there's a new, a friend of mine, Jim Lovelock, has been working for some years with a close friend of his. They came up with a theory entitled the Gaia Hypothesis several years ago.
Gaia?
Yes, Gaia.
How do you spell that?
I think it's G-A-I-A.
G-A-I-A.
And basically, this hypothesis says that the Earth is behaving like a living organism. And that may sound a little radical to those people that are thinking about the Earth as basically just a bunch of stuff out there, you know, a resource system that you go and exploit, and you pull stuff in and you transform it into your BMW. But in point of view, the Earth has been here much longer than we have. It gave birth to us and our species. We've been here maybe a couple million years. The Earth has been here for billions and billions of years. And we don't really know what the Earth is. It's a great mystery. We have something that we call science. But just imagine if our whole culture were a little cluster of cells somewhere down on the left side of the liver, And that little cluster of cells was trying to figure out, what is this that I'm living within? It would be very difficult. It would probably, particularly if it was a series of cancer cells living on the liver and starting to grow, it would probably view the rest of this body that it was living within and on as simply a rather convenient kind of mass of organic stuff to utilize and extract stuff from for its own growth. And then it would put together a philosophical system that would, you know, fit that view of unlimited growth and sort of an egocentric view of the species. Now, the ecocentric view, basically says that, well, the Earth is a living organism. It's alive, just as the human body is. It's a vast body of which we are part. We're cells in that great body. All the living beings in that body have different roles and interrelationships that play a part within that great body of Mother Earth. Some of them are acting like different tissues. Some of them are acting like different organs of the body, like the tropical rainforests and the oceans are producing the oxygen and helping to uptake some of the carbon dioxide and maintain the atmospheric cycles and the rainfall cycles, and so on and so forth. Basically, the self-regulating behavior of the whole planet, so that all life is supported, is what Gaia is all about and what the Gaia hypothesis is all about. The original idea came about when they discovered that the oxygen levels of the planet were exactly maintained at that level, that if it went any higher, if you had a forest fire, you could not put it out. It would just, everything would combust. If it went down below that level that it's at, we wouldn't have enough to respire properly. And somehow, over millennia, it has maintained a perfect oxygen equilibrium for the perfect maintenance of all the different species of the Earth. And when Lovelock took a look at all the different possible mechanisms for this, he came to the conclusion that the only way the Earth can do this is through a basic self-regulation system that would be just like how the human body self-regulates itself to maintain the equilibrium and the homeostasis and stability of the body, as well as the growth of the overall body. Well, this is a revolutionary idea, of course. Then they went ahead and began to examine that principle, that hypothesis, in light of evolutionary theory. And they found the same thing began to hold true. Again and again, they found examples within evolutionary biology that basically pointed to the same truth, that the Earth was behaving like a living organism. So suddenly we're beginning to move into a view that is saying something very different than what our forefathers said, that the Earth is just a dead thing. But interestingly enough, with a few species living on it, there happened to be, you know, through survival of the fittest and all that kind of craziness, doing what they're doing. We've never really given much attention to the interconnectedness of life, the symbiotic, cooperative nature of life. But it probably began in a fairly small way and then somehow managed to grow out into this rather amazingly interconnected and mutually supporting system. And cooperation probably has been about at least 90% of that process. And there's competition in there too. But competition is just the flip side of cooperation. The two are completely intertwined, just like the yin is a part of the yang and the yang is a part of the yin. So, in a sense, I think for the first time we're beginning to look at life as and of the Earth itself, as a vast organic being whose intelligence there's no way to even begin to even speak of that, because it's beyond us. It's beyond us to know what that is or isn't. But what we can say is that the living process of the Earth, the flow of, you might say, of the life force through the organ systems and the tissues of the planet, are definitely behaving just like a body.
Of course, now, the Earth evolved itself
How does this hypothesis fit into the various stages of the Earth?
The evolution of the Earth. That's a very interesting question, because it occurred to me the other day that, you know, where does the human being fit into all of this? Are we destined just to be cancer? You know, are we the Earth's cancer? Is that it? It's an interesting question. And if we take a little more optimistic view, some people would say, oh, no, we may be the cancer now, but actually we're destined to be the intelligence of the planet.
I love that one.
Mm-hmm. If we were truly the intelligence of the planet, I doubt we would become the cancer of the planet. I think it's more likely that we represent a highly developed ego structure for the planet. You might say we're the planetary ego. We're the sense of separate self. We're the part of the planet that can say, we are here and everything else is out there.
Subjectivity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that's more the principle of modernity, starting around the Renaissance and the era of capitalism and Protestantism.
Right, tied in with that.
That also, at that time, the vision of the human as the master of the earth.
Exactly.
Which you have also in the Bible.
Right.
The command to go and master and conquer the earth.
Have dominion.
Right, dominion over all of the fields and flowers, etc.
The interesting thing is that if we look on ourselves as the development of the ego structure for planet Earth, which is my personal theory, it may be that the next phase for Earth, since we've been caught up in being very egotistical for quite a while, and manifesting that new exploration of what Earth herself is, and exploring that for Earth, maybe the next step is actually to join with other, really the step beyond, which is where the ego structure begins to see how, yes, there is separation and self-identification, but there is also tremendous interconnectedness, also a level of indivisibility, and a level at which we're all one great being again. And obviously, most interestingly, if we are to survive as a species, or maybe if the Earth herself is to survive, at least in the organic richness that she now manifests, we may have to go through that transition into valuing all the species and all of life in the same way that we value our own life and the life of our own species. In other words, we'll have to make that philosophical leap and give that same value to other forms of life that we give to our own, if we're actually going to survive ourselves.
Well, that's a curious thing. You think that Homo sapiens is the first species that has a parasitic relationship with Mother Earth rather than symbiotic? And is this a fatal flaw?
That's a hard question to answer. I mean, we've had so many other species that have been here and gone extinct, like the dinosaur species and so on. But I think we can say that there are other systems of vast intelligence on the planet right now. I've spent a lot of time with the whales and the dolphins, and there's no question that those animals are beings of tremendous intelligence. When you think about a frontal brain system that we identify with rational consciousness and intelligence that is so much larger and vaster than ours, that you can put the brain of some of those things, it would fill an entire pickup truck compared to our brain.
And their communication system is so incredibly complex.
Exactly.
If that is alone is an indication of intelligence, then they're vastly superior to us.
The feeling I've often got from spending time with the whales down in Baja, where I do these wilderness solos, is that their intelligence is, I guess an analogy would be to say it's like a galactic level awareness. Of course, the dolphins, the porpoises, are extremely intelligent too, but they're a little more, I have the feeling, a little more accessibility somehow. There's a tremendous open-heartedness to the whales and the dolphins both. When they come in, when folks go out and do a wilderness solo down there, and we've been doing these solos so that people can make a deeper connection with nature directly.
Getting out by themselves.
Getting out by themselves and basically spending 7 days after 3 days of doing some awareness training together. And then they go out for 7 days. They're completely alone but comfortable. And they stay completely present, working with their senses to connect deeply with the truth of what's in the environment without any theory. just experiencing. And what they experience is, particularly for some of the political and social leaders that have gone through this process, is absolutely amazing. One man went through this recently, who's leader of a major technological university publishing house. And when he came back, he was, his entire view of what the world was, what Earth is, the orgaic quality of Earth, the organic beingness of Earth, and his place in it had changed. And he has started up a major ecological publishing magazine, and is going to host two major conferences on Gaia through this university, which up until now has been largely focused on technology and industrial development. That's the kind of impact that a direct connection without any particular theories with Mother Earth can have, if you just go direct. And that's, of course, the kind of thing that the Native Americans did through their vision quest. And I think it's no accident that the Native Americans, because they had the vision quest, were able to cultivate. They would go out at least once in a lifetime, and usually three or four times, or the medicine people would go out sometimes once a year. And because that direct perception linked them with levels of truth that one can only know by going through the experience, out of that truth came the kinds of values we talked about in the last program, which said we will make no major changes in the Earth and in our local Earth unless we know that it will be beneficial to all of our children and all beings out to the seventh generation. That's a value system that really understands the workings of the planet and honors it. So the reason we've been doing these wilderness solar programs is to basically reintroduce that kind of a process into our culture so that we can create a different kind of value system which will have that kind of a organic wholeness to it.
And John, what kind of practical ecological measures come out of the Gaia philosophy to preserve our Earth? We talked earlier of the pollution and depletion of the air, of the soil, of the water, of the oceans. What sorts of measures does this sort of philosophical meditation lead to preserve these aspects of our natural environment?
Some people call this deep ecology. I prefer just to call it the ecological view, or since it's a sacred view, because you have a tremendously sacred feeling about life after you go through this kind of experience. What happens is you no longer can view your own life or the life of the other beings of the planet as something apart from you. You literally feel connected to everything. It's not that to say that you're totally caught up in unity, but it's to say that you feel completely interconnected. You feel the relationship with all beings, and you begin to perceive all beings as having meaning and direct relationship to you, and you to them. Again, it becomes more like family. Now, when you begin to have a relationship like family with all the different beings of the Earth, your values shift. When your values shift, then you begin to place priority on things like, well, if I build a power plant down here, or I'm going to put a nuclear power plant over here, or I'm going to put an industry over there that's polluting the river, it's going to kill all my brothers and sisters who live in that river. It's going to kill part of me, what I'm connected to, my part of my family. The Native Americans called the plants, and they had the four-leggeds and the winged people and the stone people, and they saw everything in that way as family. I feel that this kind of a process, particularly for widespread and a basic part of our education, the wilderness solo or the vision quest, that it would completely change the way in which we relate to nature, and that all of our laws, all of our the way that we create technology would shift. We would then say, well, obviously we're going to have technologies that work in harmony with the whole fabric of life. That's important, that we value that, we place that just as important as social security.
John, we only have about 10 minutes and we want to talk about what needs to be done. We've talked about a need to change philosophically.
But the world isn't a very philosophical place. When you talk about multinational corporations and capitalism and banks and social Eastern Europe and the governments they've had there, Stalinism, all just destroying the earth for power and profits and production. From the things you've told us last time, we're facing incredible disasters. We must take enormous steps immediately, I would assume.
There is a lot of levels for hope. I personally feel that one of the best things that people can do is to take direct action in their own lives on issues that they have a direct relationship with. I mentioned last time that the work that we did to stop a major copper smelter in Arizona that was directly affecting, polluting the air of everyone in southern Arizona. Everyone living in this country has issues directly affecting them in their lives today. And I'm a strong advocate of taking direct action to make the changes. If government is resistant to the kinds of changes that need to be made, get together with your friends and take a direct action. Go ahead and chain yourself to a bulldozer if necessary. The main thing is when you take a direct action and you make a statement like that, a very strong statement, put your life on the line if you do that, is to keep a good, compassionate heart. A good ecological warrior has a loving heart. Gandhi always honored and respected his opponents and saw the basic humanity of them underneath. But he was a warrior at the same time. He took the courageous action, he put his life on the line where necessary. And I'm saying this because I feel that ecological activism is on the rise. People are really fed up. And there's a danger that activism could fall into the pit of becoming filled with anger and hatred. Then we would just be in the situation of Lebanon or the Middle East, where you have all the factionalism and the fundamentalism, and the hatred only feeds on itself. So it's very important for activists to radiate compassion and love to their opponents. At the same time, they're taking the action. There needs to be a real understanding. It's not easy if you're sitting there chained to a tree and the logger is coming at you with a chainsaw with hate in his eyes. But it's good practice. At another level, okay, there are many, many actions that people can take. In your everyday life, there are all kinds of shifts that you can make to bring solar energy into your home, to bring recycling into your household, to bring a reduction, a simpler lifestyle into your life. If you live more simply, you'll have lower taxes, you'll have fewer worries, you'll have fewer possessions to worry about. I'm amazed when people go out and solo. The one thing they tell me consistently is, and when I go back, John, I'm going to simplify my life tremendously, because I realize for the first time that I really don't need very much to be happy, because these people go out with basically nothing and spend a week with nothing and realize that they're blissfully happy just being in nature with nothing. So why do they tie themselves up in knots back in the cities to support all this stuff, which is making them unhappy, basically? They're suffering as a result of their stuff. So it only makes sense that you simplify your stuff and you boil it down to a more centralized form of living that's in harmony with nature, and reduce your consumption. If we could reduce our consumption, we could dramatically reduce our impact on the environment. The United States is consuming probably close to half the world's resources. We have, what, 5% of the world's population?
I've seen estimates as high as 60% of the world's resources.
Yeah.
What about on the sort of national and even global level? These environmental problems are global. Mm-hmm. The air, the water, the earth, all of these ecological systems are interconnected. So what can people do to stop pollution on a more national level?
Well, one of the things that I've been doing, give you another sort of practical example, there are some very good organizations doing important work. Rainforest Action Network out in San Francisco is an excellent group working on the tropical forest issues. Our Threshold Foundation has something called the Environmental Crisis Fund. And the philosophy behind that is to basically have people tithe a portion of their salary, their gross salary, And then that salary, maybe 5% of their gross salary, goes directly into environmental crises where a small amount of money can have a powerful impact. Usually, if you're trying to get a grant for a project, you may sit back and try to get that money for a year if you're going through a federal agency or a major foundation. Very often, a rainforest is lost before you can raise the money to do anything about it. So we thought it was important to have a fund that could immediately provide cash, immediately, to help support flying, for example, a rainforest person, perhaps a tribal elder from the rainforest, to testify before a congressional hearing in Congress. Maybe an appropriations committee meeting that's being called on whether or not to give a big hunk of money to the World Bank to build a dam that will flood the rainforest where that man lives. And it has to be done within a week. So you can put your own energy, your work, and your help towards those kinds of outfits. And you can certainly help them through your financing. I think it's very appropriate to tithe yourself and help out the environmental organizations that are doing such hard work today. When you look at the amount of money going into all of the other often very socially questionable causes, and you look at the poverty of the environmental movement, I think it's about time we at least tithed ourselves 5 or 10% for the Earth.
And is there enough of an environmental movement to save the environment at this stage in history?
It's building. I don't think we're anywhere close to having a sufficiently powerful movement to solve what's ahead of us. That's why I'm saying we have to really get to work.
We don't have the power. The people who have the power are the ones who are benefiting in the short term from exploiting the earth and destroying it. Are these people getting an increased sense of consciousness?
In a few cases, perhaps. But there's a tendency for folks that have a lot of power to hold on to their power at any cost. And my own feeling is that at this point in time, we have to put tremendously strong pressure on all of the channels of change in government.
Corporations, government. George Bush claims he's the environmental president. In the earlier show, you critiqued Ronald Reagan for his disastrous ecological policies. Do you see any shift in Bush, or is this just rhetoric?
I think Bush is a much more adroit politician. And he basically reads the currents and the winds of change, says the right thing, and then does what he really wants to do behind the scenes.
Which is to develop
corporate... For example, I saw in the paper today that yesterday he made a big pronouncement about how wonderful Earth Day was. The next day, what did the Interior Department do? It went out and announced that it was opening up a whole new spectrum of oil leasing opportunities along our coasts. Hmm. I mean, what does that tell you? Judge the man by his actions. Not by his words.
What would be your final message to the American people out there?
Place the environment first in your life, at least for the next 20 years. Make that number one. And put your energy, a good hunk of your time, and tithe yourself some of your money, your income, to put directly towards turning things around and the creation of an ecologically sustainable society, and not just helping your own immediate life in your neighborhood and your town and your county and your state, your region, and your bioregion, but also putting something into helping the global issues of tropical deforestation, the tremendous destruction of the oceans, which is upon us. I mean, we're just beginning to address the tremendous loss of the oxygen-producing plankton that we have on the oceans. We're seeing the need for having all of our fleets of oil tankers, I think, triple-hulled, not just double-hulled. And we need to do something about the unbelievable overfishing that's going on around the planet and the poisoning of the seas. We're reaching the level now where the oceans themselves are being poisoned. So, in any case, I would say that really dedicate yourself 100% to the transformation of yourself, your family, your immediate community, your county and state, and your country, and then give what you can towards the creation of a truly stable ecological society, even on a global level. But it's going to take 100% commitment on the part of many people to do this. I do not think it's impossible. I think it's feasible. And I can tell you one other element that will help in this is to go out and do periodic wilderness solos of at least a week. go into nature as simple as possible, with as few possessions as possible, without any particular theories, no particular religious philosophies. Open yourself up to nature and ask nature to teach you and to give you life and spirit again. You will be amazed at how you will change.
Here are the names again of the books which were written by John Milton, Future Environments of North America, and The Careless Technology. Now we have time for a couple of news stories from the Alternative Press.
The Department of Energy has suspended handling of all plutonium at the Rocky Flats nuclear weapons plant in Colorado. Now, the reason they did this was because some environmental groups heard that there were some problems with security at the gate. And what they did was they set up a little test. It turns out that at the gate of Rocky Flats, they had metal detectors to check for people that might be carrying plutonium in and out. And a lot of the workers there wear steel-toed boots. And so they were, the steel-toed boots of these workers were setting off the metal detectors. And the security guards got sick and tired of hearing it. So what they did was they turned the sensitivity way down on the metal detectors. And so what they did was they went in and they smuggled out an enormous amount of plutonium in people's boots.
It's and, crazy.
Well, they made little lead cases. And this was to demonstrate the fact that there was all these security breaches.
Oh, I see.
So they wrote it up and they got it all set up. And then they made these little lead balloons, and they put plutonium in them, stuck them in the toes of the boots, and they walked out of the plant.
They're kind of carrying plutonium out in their breeches.
Exactly, exactly. So, no more plutonium handling at Rocky Flats, which is probably a good thing, because if I were a terrorist, I'd want to get my hands on some plutonium, because it's the trigger for atomic weapons. And I read somewhere, I don't have the data here, but I read somewhere that over 20% of the plutonium in this country is unaccounted for. It's gone. Can't seem to be found. So maybe this is one of the reasons, the steel-toed boots. Well, in northwestern Indiana, stores are having a terrible time keeping garden gloves and garbage bags in stock. The reason? People are loading up on those items to harvest marijuana that's growing along the sides of the highways in Indiana. It turns out that marijuana grows wild up there and all through the Midwest, really. Even though the DEA destroys as many as 20 million plants a year every harvest, that's only a fraction of the crop. Most of the plants are left over from World War II, when licenses were issued to a few lucky farmers to grow marijuana. Now, the reason is that marijuana is one of the most useful of all plants. It's actually called the hemp plant, which is another species of marijuana. And it's been used for centuries, for millennia, actually, as one of the most useful plants for mankind. A California group and Normal, the marijuana legalization group, have gotten together, and they think that marijuana and its legalization would be the most appropriate way to bail out the savings and loans. Yeah, an article here in the Wall Street Journal. It says that the savings and loan industry could recoup its losses by allowing debtors to invest in hemp. Marijuana income for 1988 was $41 billion. And it adds that the money generated by sales of relaxational hemp could pay off the bailout, but the total revenues that would be generated by legal commerce in non-smoking hemp in other uses would be 10 to 100 times what you could make with what they call relaxational hemp. Hemp can be used for fuel, cooking oil. It makes great fabric, which holds shape as well as polyester, and it can be woven as smooth as silk or as intricate as lace.
Didn't they make rope out of it for centuries?
Exactly. That's why special licenses were issued during the Second World War, because it was the only place that you could get good rope. The U.S. government distributed 400,000 pounds of seeds and asked them to cultivate hemp because the Manila species had been cut off by the Japanese.
But this isn't the type you can smoke.
Well, you can, but it doesn't have the same THC content that some of the more relaxational species do.
I see.
So if you pick some of that pot that's grown on the side of the road in northwestern Indiana, for example, you'll get a buzz, but it's not like smoking some good sensimilia. Let's see, hemp is the strongest rot-resistant fiber known. Let's see, dynamite, paper, particle board, rope, twine, linen, canvas, cellophane, and burlap can be made from its fiber. And as late as 1938, more than half of the linen fabric imported by the United States was made from hemp. These groups that are touting hemp as a way to really help the economy, save the economy maybe, are appealing to nationalist feelings as well. The Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States were both written on hemp paper. That's no joke. The father of our country, George Washington, 70% of his crops were hemp, and he was known to dabble in relaxational hemp.
Oh.
The guy was high all the time. No wonder he was such a great leader. Really. That's no kidding. What Bill Bennett said when he was asked about this was, he said, well, what they did socially back then is different from today. It doesn't relate. But so he admitted it in this case. These people point out that although illegal cannabis is already the largest cash crop in several states, and they called the RTC to see about bailing out the thrifts with this hemp. And one of the spokesmen said that he saw political problems with using marijuana to support failed savings and loans, but he offered an alternative. He said, my alternative is to make it available to taxpayers to ease the trauma of paying for the bailout, which I thought was a nice idea.
Must be a 60s generation man.
I sure hope so. We could use a few of those.
And that's alternative views for this. We'd like to thank Robert Wilkinson, who arranged for our interview with John Milton, and the three people who assisted in editing, Laurie Lackland, Melissa 13. Goodbye.